They not only had to take it away, but also had to open the windows and perfume my room in order to remove the least traces of an odor that had become hateful to me in an instant. The strangest part of it is that since then, I have never been able to eat pineapple without practically forcing myself. Women who are too coddled or who coddle themselves too much are the ones who present the most morbid phenomena. Those that go through the ordeal of pregnancy the most easily are, on one hand, matrons totally devoted to their function as breeders and, on the other hand, mannish women who are not fascinated by the adventures of their bodies and who do everything they can to triumph over them with ease. Madame de Stael went through pregnancy as easily as a conversation. As the pregnancy proceeds, the relation between mother and fetus changes. It is solidly settled in the maternal womb. The two organisms adapt to each other, and there are biological exchanges between them allowing the woman to regain her balance. She no longer feels possessed by the species. She herself possesses the fruit of her womb. The first months she was an ordinary woman, and diminished by the secret labor taking place in her. Later, she is obviously a mother, and her malfunctions are the reverse of her glory. The increasing weakness she suffers from becomes an excuse. Many women then find a marvelous peace in their pregnancy. They feel justified. They always liked to observe themselves, to spy on their bodies. Because of their sense of social duty, they did not dare to focus on their body with too much self-indulgence. Now they have the right to. Everything they do for their own well-being, they also do for the child. They are not required to work or make an effort. They no longer have to pay attention to the rest of the world. The dreams of the future they cherish have meaning for the present moment. They only have to enjoy the moment. They are on vacation. The reason for their existence is there in their womb and gives them a perfect impression of plenitude. It is like a stove in winter that is always lit, that is there for you alone, entirely subject to your will. It is also like a constantly gushing cold shower in the summer, refreshing you. It is there, says a woman quoted by Helena Deutsch. Fulfilled, woman also experiences the satisfaction of feeling interesting, which has been, since her adolescence, her deepest desire. As a wife, she suffered from her dependence on man. At present, she is no longer sex object or servant, but she embodies the species. She is the promise of life, of eternity. Her friends and family respect her. Even her caprices become sacred. This is what encourages her, as we have seen, to invent cravings. Pregnancy permits woman to rationalize performances which otherwise would appear absurd, says Helena Deutsch. Justified by the presence within her of another, she finally fully enjoys being herself. Colette wrote about this phase of her pregnancy in L'Étoile Vespère, The Evening Star. Insidiously, unhurriedly, I was invaded by the beatitude of the woman great with child. I was no longer the prey of any malaise, any unhappiness. Euphoria, purring. What scientific or familiar name can one give to this saving grace? It must certainly have filled me to overflowing, for I haven't forgotten it. One grows weary of suppressing what one has never said, such as the state of pride, of banal magnificence, which I savored in ripening my fruit. Every evening, I said a small farewell to one of the good periods of my life. I was well aware that I should regret it, but the cheerfulness, the purring, the euphoria submerged everything, and I was governed by the calm animality, the unconcern, with which I was charged by my increasing weight and the muffled call of the being I was forming. 6th, 7th month. The first strawberries, the first roses. Can I call pregnancy anything but a long holiday? One forgets the anguish of the term. One doesn't forget a unique long holiday. I've forgotten none of it. I particularly recall that sleep used to overwhelm me at capricious hours, and that I would be seized, as in my childhood, by the desire to sleep on the ground, on the grass, on warm straw. Unique craving, healthy craving. Towards the end, I had the air of a rat that drags a stolen egg. Uncomfortable in myself, I would be too tired to go to bed. Even then, the weight and the tiredness did not interrupt my long holiday. I was born on a shield of privilege and solicitude. This happy pregnancy was called by one of Colette's friends a man's pregnancy, and she seemed to be the epitome of these women who valiantly support their state because they are not absorbed in it. She continued her work as a writer at the same time. The child showed signs of coming first, and I screwed on the top of my pen. Other women are more weighed down. They mull indefinitely over their new importance. With just a little encouragement, they adopt masculine myths. They juxtapose the lucidity of the mind to the fertile night of life, clear consciousness to the mysteries of interiority, sterile freedom to the weight of this womb there in its enormous facticity. The future mother smells of humus and earth, spring and root. When she dozes, her sleep is that of chaos where worlds ferment. There are those more forgetful of self who are especially enchanted with the treasure of life growing in them. This is the joy Cécile Sauvage expresses in her poems in L'âme en bourgeon, The Soul in Bud. You belong to me as dawn to the plain. Around you my life is a warm fleece, where your chilly limbs grow in secret. And further on, O you whom I fearfully cuddle in fleecy cotton, little soul in bud attached to my flower, with a piece of my heart I fashion your heart, O my cottony fruit, little moist mouth. Note, translated by Beverly B. Brahek, translation. And in a letter to her husband, It's funny, it seems to me I am watching the formation of a tiny planet, and that I am kneading its frail globe. I have never been so close to life. I have never so felt I am sister of the earth, with all vegetation and sap. My feet walk on the earth as on a living beast. I dream of the day full of flutes, of awakened bees, of dew, because here he is bucking and stirring in me. If you knew what springtime freshness and what youth this soul in bud puts in my heart. And to think this is Pierrot's infant soul, and that in the night of my being, it is elaborating two big eyes of infinity like his. In contrast are women who are very flirtatious, who grasp themselves essentially as erotic objects, who love themselves in the beauty of their bodies, and who suffer from seeing themselves deformed, ungainly, incapable of arousing desire. Pregnancy does not at all appear to them as a celebration or an enrichment, but as a diminishing of their self. In My Life by Isadora Duncan, one can read, among other observations, The child asserted itself now more and more. It was strange to see my beautiful marble body softened and broken and stretched and deformed. As I walked beside the sea, I sometimes felt an excess of strength and prowess, and I thought this creature would be mine, mine alone. But on other days, I felt myself some poor animal in a mighty trap. With alternate hope and despair, I often thought of the pilgrimage of my childhood, my youth, my wanderings, my discoveries in art, and they were as a misty, faraway prologue leading up to this, the before birth of a child. What any peasant woman could have. I began to be assailed with all sorts of fears. In vain I told myself that every woman had children. It was all in the course of life, etc. I was nevertheless conscious of fear. Of what? Certainly not of death, nor even of pain, some unknown fear of what I did not know. More and more my lovely body bulged under my astonished gaze. Where was my lovely, youthful, naiad form? Where my ambition, my fame? Often, in spite of myself, I felt very miserable and defeated. This game with the giant life was too much. But then I thought of the child to come, and all such painful thoughts ceased. Helpless, cruel hours of waiting in the night. With what a price we pay for the glory of motherhood. In the last stage of pregnancy begins the separation between mother and child. Women experience his first movement differently, his kick knocking at the doors of the world, knocking against the wall of the womb that encloses him away from the world. Some women welcome and marvel at this signal announcing the presence of an autonomous life, Others think of themselves with repugnance as the receptacle of a foreign individual. Once again, the union of fetus and maternal body is disturbed. The uterus descends. The woman has a feeling of pressure, tension, respiratory trouble. She is possessed this time not by the indistinct species, but by this child who is going to be born. Until then, he was just an image, a hope. He becomes heavily present. His reality creates new problems. Every passage is anguishing. The birth appears particularly frightening. When the woman comes close to term, all the infantile terrors come back to life. If, from a feeling of guilt, she thinks she is cursed by her mother, she persuades herself she is going to die or that the child will die. In War and Peace, Tolstoy painted in the character of Lise one of these infantile women who see a death sentence in birth, and she does die. Depending on the case, the birth takes many different forms. The mother wants both to keep in her womb the treasure of her flesh that is a precious piece of herself, and to get rid of an intruder. She wants finally to hold her dream in her hands, but she is afraid of new responsibilities this materialization will create. Either desire can win, but she is often divided. Often also, she does not come to the anguishing ordeal with a determined heart. She intends to prove to herself and to her family, her mother, her husband, that she is capable of surmounting it without help. But at the same time, she resents the world, life, and her family for the suffering inflicted on her. And in protest, she adopts a passive attitude. Independent women, matrons, or masculine women attach great importance to playing an active role in the period preceding and even during the birth. Very infantile women let themselves passively go to the midwife, to their mother. Some take pride in not crying out. Others refuse to follow any recommendations. On the whole, it can be said that in this crisis, they express their deepest attitude to the world in general, and to their motherhood in particular. They are stoic, resigned, demanding, imperious, revolted, inert, tense. These psychological dispositions have an enormous influence on the length and difficulty of the birth, which also, of course, depends on purely organic factors. What is significant is that normally woman, like some domesticated female animals, needs help to accomplish the function to which nature destines her. There are peasants in rough conditions and shamed young unmarried mothers who give birth alone. But their solitude often brings about the death of the child, or for the mother, incurable illnesses. At the very moment woman completes the realization of her feminine destiny, she is still dependent, which also proves that in the human species, nature can never be separated from artifice. With respect to nature, the conflict between the interest of the feminine person and that of the species is so acute, it often brings about the death of either the mother or the child. Human interventions by doctors and surgeons have considerably reduced, and even almost eliminated, the accidents that were previously so frequent. Anesthetic methods are in the process of giving the lie to the biblical affirmation, "In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children." They are commonly used in America and are beginning to spread to France. In March 1949, a decree has just made them compulsory in England. Note, I have already said that some anti-feminists, in the name of nature and the Bible, were indignant at the attempt to eliminate the suffering of childbirth. It is supposed to be one of the sources of the maternal instinct. Helena Deutsch seems tempted by this opinion. She writes that when the mother has not felt the labor of childbirth, she does not profoundly recognize the child as her own at the moment she is presented with him. However, she agrees that the same feeling of emptiness and strangeness is encountered in women who have given birth and suffered. And she maintains all through her book that maternal love is a feeling, a conscious attitude, and not an instinct, that it is not necessarily linked to pregnancy. According to her, a woman can maternally love an adopted child or one her husband has had from a first marriage, and so on. This contradiction obviously comes from the fact that she has destined woman to masochism, and her thesis demands she grant a high value to feminine suffering. It is difficult to know exactly what suffering these methods save women from. The fact that delivery sometimes lasts more than 24 hours and sometimes is completed in 2 or 3 hours prevents any generalization. For some women, childbirth is martyrdom. Such is the case of Isadora Duncan. She lived through her pregnancy in anxiety, and psychic resistance undoubtedly aggravated the pains of childbirth even more. She writes, "Talk about the Spanish Inquisition. No woman who has born a child would have to fear it. It must have been a mild sport in comparison. Relentless, cruel, knowing no release, no pity, this terrible unseen genie had me in his grip and was in continued spasms, tearing my bones and my sinews apart. They say such suffering is soon forgotten. All I have to reply is that I have only to shut my eyes and I hear again my shrieks and groans as they were then." On the other hand, some women think it is a relatively easy ordeal to bear. A small number experience sensual pleasure in it. One woman writes, "I am so strongly sexed that even childbirth means to me a sexual act. I had a very pretty madame for a nurse. She bathed me and gave me my vaginal douches. This was enough for me. It kept me in such a high state of sexual agitation that I trembled." Note, Stekel recorded this subject's confession, which I have partially summarized. Some women say they felt creative power during childbirth. They truly accomplished a voluntary and productive piece of work. Many others feel passive, a suffering and tortured instrument. The mother's first relations with the newborn vary as well. Some women suffer from this emptiness they now feel in their bodies. It seems to them that someone has stolen their treasure. Cécile Sauvage writes, "I am the hive without speech, whose swarm has flown into the air. No longer do I bring back the beakful of my blood to your frail body. My being is a closed-up house from which they have removed a body." And more, "No longer are you mine alone. Your head already reflects other skies." And also, "He is born. I have lost my young beloved. Now that he is born, I am alone, I feel, terrifying within me the void of my blood." Note, translated by Beverly B. Brahek, translation. Yet at the same time, there is a wondrous curiosity in every young mother. It is a strange miracle to see, to hold a living being formed in and coming out of oneself. But what part has the mother really had in the extraordinary event that brings a new existence into the world? She does not know. The being would not exist without her, and yet he escapes her. There is a surprising sadness in seeing him outside, cut off from herself. And there is almost always a disappointment. The woman would like to feel him hers as surely as her own hand, but everything he feels is closed up inside him. He is opaque, impenetrable, apart. She does not even recognize him, since she does not know him. She lived her pregnancy without him. She has no common past with this little stranger. She expected to be familiar right away, but no, he is a newcomer, and she is stupefied by the indifference with which she receives him. In her pregnancy reveries, he was an image, he was infinite, and the mother mentally played out her future motherhood. Now he is a tiny, finite individual. He is really there, contingent, fragile, demanding. The joy that he is finally here, quite real, is mingled with a regret that this is all he is. After the initial separation, many young mothers regain an intimate animal relationship with their children through nursing. This is a more stressful fatigue than that of pregnancy, but it allows the nursing mother to prolong the vacation state of peace and plenitude she relished in pregnancy. Colette Audry says of one of her heroines, "When the baby was suckling, there was really nothing else to do, and it could last for hours. She did not even think of what would come after. She could only wait for him to release her breast like a big bee." Note, playing a losing game. But there are women who cannot nurse, and in whom the surprising indifference of the first hours continues until they regain concrete bonds with the child. This was the case, among others, with Colette, who was not able to nurse her daughter and who describes her first maternal feelings with her customary sincerity. The outcome is the contemplation of a new person who has entered the house without coming in from outside. Did I devote enough love to my contemplation? I should not like to say so. True, I had the capacity, I still have, for wonder. I exercised it on that assembly of marvels which is the newborn, her nails resembling in their transparency the convex scale of the pink shrimp, the soles of her feet, which have reached us without touching the ground, the light plumage of her lashes, lowered over her cheek, interposed between the scenes of earth and the bluish dream of her eye. The small sex, a barely incised almond, a bivalve precisely closed, lip to lip. But the meticulous admiration I devoted to my daughter, I did not call it, I did not feel it as love. I waited. I did not derive from these scenes, so long awaited in my life, the vigilance and emulation of besotted mothers. When, then, would be vouchsafed to me the sign that was to mark my second, more difficult violation? I had to accept that an accumulation of warnings, of furtive, jealous outbursts, of false premonitions, and even of real ones, the pride in managing an existence of which I was the humble creditor, the somewhat perfidious awareness of giving the other love a lesson in modesty, would eventually change me into an ordinary mother. Yet I only regained my equanimity when intelligible speech blossomed on those ravishing lips, when recognition, malice, and even tenderness turned a run-of-the-mill baby into a little girl, and a little girl into my daughter. Note, Evening Star. There are also many mothers who are terrified of their new responsibilities. During pregnancy, they had only to abandon themselves to their flesh. No initiative was demanded of them. Now, in front of them is a person who has rights to them. Some women happily caress their babies while they are still in the hospital, still gay and carefree, but upon returning home, they start to regard them as burdens. Even nursing brings them no joy, and on the contrary, they worry about ruining their breasts. They resent feeling their cracked breasts, their painful glands. The baby's mouth hurts them. He seems to be sucking their strength, life, and happiness from them. He inflicts a harsh servitude on them, and he is no longer a part of his mother. He is like a tyrant. She feels hostility for this little individual who threatens her flesh, her freedom, her whole self. Many other factors are involved. The woman's relations with her mother are still of great importance. Helena Deutsch cites the case of a young nursing mother whose milk dried up whenever her mother came to see her. She often solicits help, but is jealous of the care someone else gives to the baby and feels depressed about this. Her relations with the infant's father and the feelings he himself fosters also have a strong influence. A whole set of economic and sentimental considerations define the infant as a burden, a shackle, or a liberation, a jewel, a form of security. There are cases where hostility becomes outright hatred, resulting in extreme neglect or bad treatment. Most often, the mother, conscious of her duties, combats this hostility. She feels remorse that gives rise to anxieties, prolonging the apprehensions of pregnancy. All psychoanalysts agree that mothers who are obsessed about harming their children or who imagine horrible accidents feel an enmity toward them they force themselves to repress. What is nonetheless remarkable and distinguishes this relationship from all other human relationships is that in the beginning, the child himself does not play a part. His smiles, his babbling, have no meaning other than the one his mother gives them. It depends on her, not him, whether he seems charming, unique, bothersome, ordinary, or obnoxious. This is why cold, unsatisfied, melancholic women who expect a child to be a companion or to provide warmth and excitement that draw them out of themselves are always deeply disappointed. Like the passage into puberty, sexual initiation, and marriage, Motherhood generates morose disappointment for subjects who are waiting for an external event to renew and justify their lives. This is the sentiment found in Sofia Tolstoy. She writes, "These past 9 months have been practically the worst in my life, to say nothing of the 10th." Note, Diaries of Sofia Tolstoy. Beauvoir attributes this quotation to Sofia, but it is in fact Leo's. Translation. She tries in vain to express a conventional joy. We are struck by her sadness and fear of responsibilities. It is all over. The baby has been born, and my ordeal is at last at an end. I have risen from my bed and am gradually entering into life again, but with a constant feeling of fear and dread about my baby, and especially my husband. Something within me seems to have collapsed, and I sense that whatever it is, it will always be there to torment me. It is probably the fear of not doing my duty towards my family. I have become insincere, for I am frightened by the womb's vulgar love for its offspring, and frightened by my somewhat unnatural love for my husband. I sometimes comfort myself with the thought that most people see this love of one's husband and children as a virtue. But how strong these maternal feelings are! He is Lyovochka's child. That's why I love him. But we know very well that she only exhibits so much love for her husband because she does not love him. This antipathy marks the child conceived in embraces that disgusted her. Catherine Mansfield describes the hesitation of a young mother who loves her husband but is repulsed by his caresses. For her children, she feels tenderness and at the same time has an impression of emptiness she sadly interprets as complete indifference. Linda, resting in the garden next to her newborn, thinks about her husband Stanley. Well, she was married to him, and what was more, she loved him. Not the Stanley whom everyone saw, not the everyday one, but a timid, sensitive, innocent Stanley who knelt down every night to say his prayers. But the trouble was, she saw her Stanley so seldom. There were glimpses, moments, breathing spaces of calm, but all the rest of the time, it was like living in a house that couldn't be cured of the habit of catching on fire, on a ship that got wrecked every day. And it was always Stanley who was in the thick of the danger. Her whole time was spent in rescuing him, and restoring him, and calming him down, and listening to his story. And what was left of her time was spent in the dread of having children. It was all very well to say it was the common lot of women to bear children. It wasn't true. She, for one, could prove that wrong. She was broken, made weak, her courage was gone, through childbearing. And what made it doubly hard to bear was, she did not love her children. It was useless pretending. No, it was as though a cold breath had chilled her through and through on each of those awful journeys. She had no warmth left to give them. As to the boy, well, thank heaven, mother had taken him. He was mother's or Beryl's or anybody's who wanted him. She had hardly held him in her arms. She was so indifferent about him that as he lay there, Linda glanced down, there was something so quaint, so unexpected about that smile that Linda smiled herself. But she checked herself and said to the boy coldly, "I don't like babies." "Don't like babies?" The boy couldn't believe her. "Don't like me?" He waved his arms foolishly at his mother. Linda dropped off her chair onto the grass. "Why do you keep on smiling?" she said severely. "If you knew what I was thinking about, you wouldn't." Linda was so astonished at the confidence of this little creature. Ah, no, be sincere. That was not what she felt. It was something far different. It was something so new, so... The tears danced in her eyes. She breathed in a small whisper to the boy. "Hello, my funny." Note. At the bay. These examples all prove that there is no such thing as maternal instinct. The word does not in any case apply to the human species. The mother's attitude is defined by her total situation and by the way she accepts it, It is, as we have seen, extremely variable. But the fact is that if circumstances are not positively unfavorable, the mother will find herself enriched by a child. It was like a response to the reality of her own existence. Through him, she had a grasp on all things and on herself to begin with, wrote Colette Audry about a young mother. And she has another character say these words. He was heavy in my arms and on my breast, like the heaviest thing in the world, to the limit of my strength. He buried me in silence and darkness. All at once he had put the weight of the world on my shoulders. That was indeed why I wanted him. I was too light myself. Alone, I was too light. While some women are breeders rather than mothers, and lose interest in their child as soon as it is weaned, or as soon as it is born, and only desire another pregnancy, many others, by contrast, feel that it is the separation itself that gives them the child. It is no longer an indistinct part of themselves, but a piece of the world. It no longer secretly haunts the body, but can be seen, touched. After the melancholy of delivery, Cécile Sauvage expresses the joy of possessive motherhood. Here you are, my little lover, on your mother's big bed. I can kiss you, hold you, feel the weight of your fine future. Good day, my little statue, of blood, of joy, and naked flesh. My little double, my excitement. It has been said again and again that woman happily finds an equivalent of the penis in the infant. This is completely wrong. In fact, the adult man no longer sees his penis as a wonderful toy. His organ is valued in relation to the desirable objects it allows him to possess. By the same token, the adult woman envies the male for the prey he acquires, not the instrument of this acquisition. The infant satisfies this aggressive eroticism that the male embrace does not fulfill. The infant is homologous to this mistress that she is for the male, and that he is not for her. Of course, there is no exact correspondence. Every relation is unique, but the mother finds in the child, like the lover in the beloved, a carnal plenitude, not in surrender but in domination. She grasps in the child what man seeks in woman, an other, both nature and consciousness, who is her prey, her double. He embodies all of nature. Audrey's heroine tells us she found in her child the skin that was for my fingers to touch, that fulfilled the promise of all little kittens, all flowers. His skin has that sweetness, that warm elasticity that, as a little girl, the woman coveted in her mother's flesh, and later, everywhere in the world. He is plant and animal. He holds rains and rivers in his eyes, the azure of the sky and the sea. His fingernails are coral, his hair a silky growth. He is a living doll, a bird, a kitten. My flower, my pearl, my chick, my lamb. His mother murmurs words almost of a lover and uses, like a lover, the possessive adjective. She uses the same words of appropriation, caresses, kisses. She hugs the infant to her body. She envelops him in the warmth of her arms, of her bed. At times, these relations have a clearly sexual cast. Thus, in the confession collected by Stekel I have already cited, we heard, I nursed my baby, but I took no particular joy in doing so, because he did not thrive well. We were both losing ground. The act of nursing seemed something sexual to me. I was always ashamed of it. It was, for me, a majestic experience to feel the warm little body snuggling up to me. The touch of his little hands thrilled me. My whole love went out to him. The child would cling to me and did not leave my side. It was troublesome to try to keep him away from me. When he saw me in bed, he crawled up at once. He was 2 years of age at the time, and tried to lie on top of me. At the same time, his little hands wandered over my breasts and tried to reach down. I found this very pleasurable. It was not easy for me to send the child away. Frequently, I fought against the temptation of playing with his genitals. Motherhood takes on a new aspect when the child grows older. At first, he is only a standard baby, existing in his generality. Little by little, he becomes individualized. Very dominating or very carnal women grow cold toward him. It is then that some others, like Colette, begin to take an interest in him. The mother's relation to the child becomes more and more complex. He is a double, and at times she is tempted to alienate herself completely in him. But he is an autonomous subject, and therefore rebellious. Today he is warmly real, but in the far-off future he is an adolescent, an imaginary adult. He is her wealth, a treasure, but he is also a responsibility, a tyrant. The joy the mother can find in him is a joy of generosity. She must take pleasure in serving, giving, creating happiness, such as the mother depicted by Colette Audry. Thus, he had a happy storybook infancy, but his infancy was to storybook infancy as real roses were to postcard roses. And this happiness of his came out of me like the milk with which I nourished him. Like the woman in love, the mother is delighted to feel needed. She is justified by the demands she responds to, but what makes maternal love difficult and great is that it implies no reciprocity. The woman is not before a man, a hero, a demigod, but a little stammering consciousness, lost in a fragile and contingent body. The infant possesses no value, and he can bestow none. The woman remains alone before him. She expects no compensation in exchange for her gifts. She justifies them with her own freedom. This generosity deserves the praise that men forever bestow on her, but mystification begins when the religion of motherhood proclaims that all mothers are exemplary. For maternal devotion can be experienced in perfect authenticity, but in fact, this is rarely the case. Ordinarily, maternity is a strange compromise of narcissism, altruism, dream, sincerity, bad faith, devotion, and cynicism. The great risk our mores present for the infant is that the mother to whom he is tied and bound is almost always an unfulfilled woman. Sexually, she is frigid or unsatisfied. Socially, she feels inferior to man. She has no hold on the world or the future. She will try to compensate for her frustrations through the child. When one recognizes how the present situation of woman makes her full development difficult, how many desires, revolts, pretensions, and claims she secretly harbors, one is frightened that helpless little children are given over to her. Just as when she both pampered and tortured her dolls, her behavior is symbolic, but these symbols become bitter reality for the child. A mother who beats her child does not only beat the child, and in a way she does not beat him at all, she is taking her vengeance on man, on the world, or on herself. But it is the child who receives the blows. Mulugi expresses this painful misunderstanding in Enrico. Enrico well understands it is not he whom his mother beats so wildly, and waking from her delirium, she sobs with remorse and tenderness. He does not hold it against her, but he is no less disfigured by her blows. And the mother described in Violette Le Duc's In the Prison of Her Skin, in lashing out against her daughter, is in fact taking revenge on the seducer who abandoned her, on life that humiliated and defeated her. This cruel aspect of motherhood has always been known, but with hypocritical prudishness, the idea of the bad mother has been diffused by inventing the cruel stepmother. The father's second wife torments the child of the deceased good mother. Indeed, Madame Fichigny is a mother figure, the exact counterpart of the edifying Madame de Fleurville, described by Madame de Ségur. Since Jules Renard's Poil de Carotte, Carrot Top, there have been more and more accusations. Enrico, in The Prison of Her Skin, Simone de Tervagne's Maternal Hatred, Hervé Bazin's Viper in the Fist. While the types sketched in these novels are somewhat exaggerated, the majority of women suppress their spontaneous impulses out of morality and decency. But these impulses flare up in scenes, slaps, anger fits, insults, punishments, and so on. In addition to frankly sadistic women, there are many who are especially capricious. What delights them is to dominate. When the baby is tiny, he is a toy. If it is a boy, they shamelessly play with his penis. If it is a girl, they treat her like a doll. Later, they only want a little slave who will blindly obey them. Vain, they show the child off like a trained pet. Jealous and exclusive, they set him apart from the rest of the world. Also, the woman often continues to expect gratitude for the care she gives the child. She shapes an imaginary being through him who will recognize her with gratitude for being an admirable mother and one in whom she recognizes herself. When Cornelia, proudly showing her children, said, "These are my jewels," she gave an ill-fated example to posterity. Too many mothers live in the hope of one day repeating this arrogant gesture, and they do not hesitate to sacrifice the little flesh-and-blood individual whose contingent and indecisive existence does not fulfill them. They force him to resemble their husbands, or, on the contrary, not to resemble them, or to reincarnate a father, a mother, or a venerated ancestor. They model him on someone prestigious. A German socialist deeply admired Lily Brown, recounts Helena Deutsch. The famous activist had a brilliant son who died young. Her imitator was determined to treat her own son like a future genius, and as a result, he became a bandit. Harmful to the child, this ill-adapted tyranny is always a source of disappointment for the mother. Deutsch cites another striking example of an Italian woman whose case history she followed for several years. Mrs. Mazzetti had a number of small children who caused her difficulties, all of them, one after the other. Personal contact with Mrs. Mazzetti soon revealed that although she sought help, it was difficult to influence her. Her entire bearing was consistently used only in face of the outside world, but in relations with her family, she gave way to uncontrolled emotional outbursts. We learned that coming from a poor, uncultured milieu, she had always had the urge to become something better. She always attended night schools and would perhaps have achieved something in harmony with her aspirations if she had not met her husband. He exerted an irresistible sexual attraction upon her. At the age of 16, she had sexual relations with him, soon became pregnant, and found herself compelled to marry him. She continually tried to raise herself again. She went to night school, etc. The man was a first-class workman. Mrs. Mazzetti evidently had emphasized her superiority to him in a very aggressive way, which drove this simple man to alcoholism. He tried to devaluate his wife's superiority by making her repeatedly pregnant. After her separation from her husband, she turned all her emotions to the children and began to treat them as she had treated her husband. As long as the children were small, she appeared to be attaining her goal. They were very ambitious, successful in school, etc. When Louise, the oldest child, approached the age of 16, her mother seems to have fallen into a state of anxiety that was based upon her own past experiences. This anxiety was expressed in heightened watchfulness and strictness, to which Louise reacted with protests and had an illegitimate child. The children emotionally clung to their father and were against their mother, who tried to impose her moral standards on them. She could never be kind to more than one of her older children at a time, and always indulged her negative, aggressive emotions at the expense of the others. Since the children thus alternated as objects of her love, the child who had just been loved was driven to rage, jealousy, and revenge. One daughter after another became promiscuous. They brought syphilis and illegitimate children into the home. The little boys began to steal, and Mrs. Mazzetti could not understand that ideal demands, instead of tender harmony, pushed them in that direction. This authoritarian upbringing and capricious sadism I spoke of are often mixed together. To justify her anger, the mother uses the pretext of wanting to shape the child, and inversely, failure in her endeavor exasperates her hostility. Masochistic devotion is another quite common attitude, and no less harmful for the child. Some mothers make themselves slaves of their offspring to compensate for the emptiness in their hearts and to punish themselves for the hostility they do not want to admit. They endlessly cultivate a morbid anxiety. They cannot bear to let their child do anything on his own. They give up all pleasure, all personal life, enabling them to assume the role of victim. And from these sacrifices, they derive the right to deny the child all independence. This renunciation is easily reconciled with a tyrannical will to domination. The Mater Dolorosa turns her suffering into a weapon she uses sadistically. Her displays of resignation spur guilt feelings in the child, which he will often carry through his whole life. They are more harmful than aggressive displays. Tossed about, baffled, the child finds no defense mechanism. Sometimes blows, sometimes tears, show him to be a criminal. The mother's main excuse is that the child is far from bringing her that satisfying self-accomplishment she was promised since childhood. She takes out on him the mystification of which she was a victim and that the child innocently exposes. She did what she wanted with her dolls. When she helped care for her sister's or a friend's baby, it was without responsibility. But now society, her husband, her mother, and her own pride hold her responsible for this little foreign life as if it were her own composition. The husband, in particular, is irritated by the child's faults, just as he is by a spoiled dinner or his wife's improper behavior. His abstract demands often weigh heavily on the mother's relation to the child. An independent woman, thanks to her solitude, her carefree state, or her authority in the household, will be much more serene than those carrying the weight of dominating demands in making her child obey. For the great difficulty is to contain within a fixed framework a mysterious existence like that of animals, turbulent and disorderly, like the forces of nature, but human nonetheless. One cannot train a child in silence like training a dog, nor persuade him with adult words. He plays on this ambiguity, pitting words against the animality of sobs and tantrums, and constraints against the insolence of language. Of course, the problem thus posed is challenging, and when she has time for it, the mother enjoys being an educator. Peacefully settled in a park, the baby is still as good an excuse as he was when he nestled in her stomach. Often still more or less infantile herself, she delights in being silly with him, reviving games, words, interests, and joys of days gone by. But when she is washing, cooking, nursing another infant, shopping, entertaining callers, and mainly when she is taking care of her husband, the child is no more than a bothersome, harassing presence. She does not have the leisure time to train him. She must first keep him from making trouble. He demolishes, tears, dirties. He is a constant danger to objects and to himself. He fidgets, he screams, he talks, he makes noise. He lives for himself, and this life disturbs his parents' life. Their interest and his do not converge. Therein lies the drama. Forever burdened by him, parents inflict sacrifices on him for reasons he does not understand. They sacrifice him for their tranquility and his own future. It is natural for him to rebel. He does not understand the explanations his mother tries to give him. She cannot penetrate his consciousness. His dreams, his phobias, his obsessions, and his desires shape an opaque world. The mother can only gropingly control a being who sees these abstract laws as absurd violence from the outside. As the child grows older, this lack of comprehension remains. He enters a world of interests and values from which his mother is excluded. He often scorns her for it. The boy in particular, proud of his masculine prerogatives, laughs off a woman's orders. She insists on him doing his homework, but she cannot solve his problems, translate his Latin text. She cannot keep up with him. The mother is sometimes driven to tears over this task, whose difficulty the husband rarely appreciates. Raising an individual with whom one does not communicate, but who is nonetheless a human being, interfering in a foreign freedom that defines and affirms itself only by rebelling against you. The situation differs depending on whether the child is a boy or a girl. And while boys are more difficult, the mother generally gets along better with them. Because of the prestige woman attributes to men, and also the privileges they hold concretely, many women wish for a son. "It's marvelous to bring a man into the world," they say. As has been seen, they dream of giving birth to a hero, and the hero is obviously of the male sex. The son will be a chief, a leader of men, a soldier, a creator. He will impose his will on the face of the earth, and his mother will share in his immortality. The houses she did not build, the countries she did not explore, the books she did not read, he will give to her. Through him, she will possess the world, but on condition that she possesses her son. This is the source of her paradoxical attitude. Freud believes that the mother-son relationship contains the least ambivalence. But in fact, in motherhood, as in marriage and love, woman has an ambiguous attitude to masculine transcendence. If her conjugal or love life has made her hostile to men, she will find satisfaction in dominating the male reduced to his infantile figure. She will treat the arrogantly pretentious sex organ with an ironic familiarity. At times, she will frighten the child by announcing she will cut it off if he does not behave. Even if she is humble and more peaceful and respects the future hero in her son, she does what she can to reduce him to his imminent reality in order to ensure that he is really hers. Just as she treats her husband like a child, she treats her child like a baby. It is too rational, too simple to think she wishes to castrate her son. Her dream is more contradictory. She wants him to be infinite and yet fit in the palm of her hand, dominating the whole world and kneeling before her. She encourages him to be soft, greedy, selfish, shy, sedentary. She forbids sports and friends, and she makes him unsure of himself because she wants to have him for herself. But she is disappointed if he does not at the same time become an adventurer, a champion, a genius she can be proud of. There is no doubt that her influence is often harmful. As Montholon maintains, and as Mauriac demonstrates in Génitrix, luckily, boys can fairly easily escape this hold. Customs and society encourage them to. And the mother herself is resigned to it. She knows very well that the struggle against man is unfair. She consoles herself by acting the Mater Dolorosa, or by pondering the pride of having given birth to one of her conquerors. The little girl is more wholly under the control of her mother. Her claims on her daughter are greater. Their relations assume a much more dramatic character. The mother does not greet a daughter as a member of the chosen caste. She seeks a double in her. She projects onto her all the ambiguity of her relationship with herself. And when the alterity of this alter ego affirms itself, she feels betrayed. The conflicts we have discussed become all the more intensified between mother and daughter. There are women who are satisfied enough with their lives to want to reincarnate themselves in a daughter, or at least welcome her without disappointment. They would like to give their child the same chances they had, as well as those they did not have. They will give her a happy youth. Colette traced the portrait of one of those well-balanced and generous mothers. Sidot cherishes her daughter in her freedom. She fulfills her without ever making demands in return because her joy comes from her own heart. It can happen that in devoting herself to this double in whom she recognizes and transcends herself, the mother ends up totally alienating herself in her. She renounces herself. Her only care is for her child's happiness. She will even be egotistical and hard toward the rest of the world. She runs the danger of becoming annoying to the one she adores, as did Madame de Sévigné from Madame de Grignon. The disgruntled daughter will try to rid herself from such tyrannical devotion. Often she is unsuccessful, and she lives her whole life as a child, frightened of responsibilities because she has been too sheltered. But it is especially a certain masochistic form of motherhood that risks weighing heavily on the young daughter. Some women feel their femininity as an absolute curse, They wish for or accept a daughter with the bitter pleasure of finding another victim. And at the same time, they feel guilt at having brought her into the world. Their remorse and the pity they feel for themselves through their daughter are manifested in endless anxieties. They will never take a step away from the child. They will sleep in the same bed for 15 or 20 years. The little girl will be destroyed by the fire of this disquieting passion. Most women both claim and detest their feminine condition. They experience it in resentment. The disgust they feel for their sex could incite them to give their daughters a virile education. They are rarely generous enough to do so. Irritated at having given birth to a female, the mother accepts her with this ambiguous curse. You will be a woman. She hopes to redeem her inferiority by turning this person she considers a double into a superior being, and she also has a tendency to inflict on her the defect she has had to bear. At times, she tries to impose exactly her own destiny on her child. What was good enough for me is good enough for you. This is the way I was brought up, so you will share my lot. And at times, by contrast, she fiercely forbids her to resemble her. She wants her own experience to be useful. It is a way to get even. The courtesan will send her daughter to a convent. The ignorant woman will give her an education. In the prison of her skin, the mother who sees the hated consequence of a youthful error in her daughter tells her with fury, "Try to understand. If such a thing happened to you, I would disown you. I did not know a thing. Sin. A vague idea, sin. If a man calls you, don't go. Go on your way. Don't turn back. Do you hear me? You've been warned. This must not happen to you. And if it happened, I would have no pity. I would leave you in the gutter." We have seen that Mrs. Mazzetti, because she wanted to spare her daughter from her own error, precipitated it. Stekel recounts a complex case of maternal hatred of a daughter. "I know a mother who disliked at birth her fourth daughter, a quiet, charming girl. She claimed that this child had inherited, in concentrated measure, all her father's unpleasant traits. The child was born to her during the year when this exalted, dreamy woman had fallen passionately in love with another man, a poet, who was courting her. During her husband's embraces, she permitted her mind to dwell on the poet, hoping that the child would thus become endowed with her beloved's traits, as in Goethe's elective affinities. However, the child looked so much like its father from the moment of its birth that its paternity was obvious. She saw in the child a reflection of herself, a reflection of the dreamy, tender, yielding, sensual side of herself. She despised these qualities, scorned them in herself. She would have preferred to have been strong, unyielding, vigorous, prudish, and energetic. Thus, she hated herself even more than she hated her husband through her hatred of the child. Note: Conditions of Nervous Anxiety and Their Treatment. Translation. It is when the girl grows up that real conflicts arise. We have seen that she wishes to affirm her autonomy from her mother. This is, in her mother's eyes, a mark of detestable ingratitude. She obstinately tries to tame this determination that is lurking. She cannot accept that her double becomes an other. The pleasure man savors in women, feeling absolutely superior, is something a woman experiences only toward her children, and her daughters in particular. She feels frustration if she renounces these privileges and her authority. Whether she is a passionate or a hostile mother, her child's independence ruins her hopes. She is doubly jealous of the world that takes her daughter and of her daughter who, in conquering part of the world, robs her of it. This jealousy first involves the father-daughter relationship. Sometimes the mother uses the child to keep her husband home. If this fails, she is vexed. But if her maneuver succeeds, she is sure to revive her infantile complex in an inverted form. She becomes irritated by her daughter as she was once by her own mother. She sulks. She feels abandoned and misunderstood. A French woman married to a foreigner who loved his daughters very much angrily said one day. I've had enough of living with these wogs. Often the eldest daughter, the father's favorite, is the target of the mother's persecution. The mother heaps the worst chores on her, demands a seriousness beyond her age. Since she is a rival, she will be treated as an adult. She too will learn that life is not a storybook romance. Everything is not rosy. You can't do whatever you please. You're not on earth to have fun. Very often, the mother strikes the child for no reason, simply to teach her a lesson. She wants to show her she is still in charge. For what vexes her the most is that she does not have any real superiority to set against a girl of 11 or 12. The latter can already perform household tasks perfectly well. She is a little woman. She even has a liveliness, curiosity, and lucidity that in many regards make her superior to adult women. The mother likes to rule over her feminine universe without competition. She wants to be unique, irreplaceable. And yet here her young assistant reduces her to the pure generality of her function. She scolds her daughter sternly if, after being away for 2 days, she finds her household in disorder. But she goes into fits of anger if it so happens that family life continued along well without her. She cannot accept that her daughter will really become her double, a substitute of herself. Yet it is still more intolerable that she should boldly assert herself as an other. She systematically detests the girlfriends in whom her daughter seeks succor against family oppression, friends who spur her on. She criticizes them, prevents her daughter from seeing them too often, or even uses the pretext of their bad influence to radically forbid her to be with them. All influence that is not her own is bad. She has a particular animosity toward women of her own age, teachers, girlfriends' mothers, toward whom her daughter turns her affection. She declares these sentiments absurd or unhealthy. At times, gaiety, silliness, or children's games and laughter are enough to exasperate her. She more readily accepts this of boys. They are exercising their male privilege, as is natural, and she has long given up this impossible competition. But why should this other woman enjoy advantages that she has been refused? Imprisoned in the snares of seriousness, she envies all occupations and amusements that wrench her daughter from the boredom of the household. This escape makes a sham of all the values to which she has sacrificed herself. The older the child gets, the more this bitterness eats at the mother's heart. Every year brings the mother closer to her decline. From year to year, the youthful body develops and flourishes. This future opening up to her daughter seems to be stolen from the mother. This is why some mothers become irritated when their daughters first get their period. They begrudge their consecration from now on as newly become women. This new woman is offered still indefinite possibilities in contrast to the repetition and routine that are the lot of the older woman. These chances are what the mother envies and detests. Not able to take them herself, she tries to diminish or suppress them. She keeps her daughter home, watches over her, tyrannizes her, dresses her like a frump on purpose, refuses her all pastimes, goes into rages if the adolescent puts on makeup if she goes out. She turns all her own rage toward life against this young life who is embarking on a new future. She tries to humiliate the young girl. She ridicules her ventures. She bullies her. Open war is often declared between them, and it is usually the younger woman who wins as time is on her side. But victory has a guilty taste. Her mother's attitude gives rise to both revolt and remorse. Her mother's presence alone makes her the guilty one. We have seen how this sentiment can seriously affect her future. Willy-nilly, the mother accepts her defeat in the end. When her daughter becomes an adult, they reestablish a more or less distressed friendship. But one of them will forever be disappointed and frustrated. The other will often be haunted by a curse. We will return later to the older woman's relations with her adult children. But it is clear that for their first 20 years, they occupy a most important place in the mother's life. A dangerous misconception about two currently accepted preconceived ideas strongly emerges from the descriptions we have made. The first is that motherhood is enough in all cases to fulfill a woman. This is not at all true. Many are the mothers who are unhappy, bitter, and unsatisfied. The example of Sofia Tolstoy, who gave birth more than 12 times, is significant. She never stops repeating, all through her diary, that everything seems useless and empty in the world and in herself. Children bring a kind of masochistic peace for her. With the children, I do not feel young anymore. I am calm and happy. Renouncing her youth, her beauty, and her personal life brings her some calm. She feels old, justified. The feeling of being indispensable to them is my greatest happiness. They are weapons enabling her to reject her husband's superiority. My only resources, my only weapons to establish equality between us are the children, energy, joy, health. But they are absolutely not enough to give meaning to an existence worn down by boredom. On January 25, 1875, after a moment of exaltation, she writes, "I too want and can do everything. But as soon as this feeling goes away, I realize I don't want and can't do anything except care for my babies, eat, drink, sleep, love my husband and my children, which should really be happiness, but which makes me sad and, like yesterday, makes me want to cry." And 11 years later, "I devote myself energetically to my children's upbringing and education and have an ardent desire to do it well. But my God, how impatient and irascible I am! How I yell! This eternal fighting with the children is so sad." The mother's relation with her children is defined within the overall context of her life. It depends on her relations with her husband, her past, her occupations, herself. It is a fatal and absurd error to claim to see a child as a panacea. This is also Helena Deutsch's conclusion in the work I have often cited, where she studies phenomena of motherhood on the basis of her experience in psychiatry. She ranks this function highly,